is this critical mass, do you think? Or nope.
I was just wondering for starting.
Wait
until a little actually done. Okay. Do you want to be introduced or don't you care?
I can introduce myself. Can you go ahead? Okay, cool. All right, so my name is Jack Wadden, and I'm a graduate student in computer science. I'm going to be giving you guys two lectures this week. This lecture is mainly on GPU architecture, modern GPU architecture. So last week, Charles introduced vector architectures, the Cray 1, and kind of the motivation for doing vector processing. I'm going to talk more about kind of why we care about graphics processing units, how they relate to vector processors, and then also how to program them. So hopefully on, you know, today we'll go over all the architecture stuff, you know, very, very high level. I'm not going to like quiz you on anything here. But Wednesday, we're going to go over, you know, maybe finish these slides and then go over the CUDA programming model, SIMT programming, OpenCL style programming, how to do that. And then I'm going to introduce your third homework assignment. And the third homework assignment is going to be CUDA programming. So by the end of this month, you'll know how to program GPUs. You can put that on your resume, and that's, you know, good for everybody. So Just a little bit about myself and my GPU background. I went to Williams College in Western Massachusetts. That's where I did my undergrad. And then I came to UVA right after Williams and started kind of doing some architecture research with Kevin Scadron, who's the department chair now. And we started doing this kind of CPU speculative trace-based automatic parallelization. It was kind of really big bad idea, and you know, GPUs were becoming super hot and GPU research was really taking off. So I decided to actually leave and take a little bit of a sabbatical and go to AMD Research and work with Sudhanva Gurumurthy, who is a former professor, and I worked on GPU reliability there. Since I've been back, I've been really interested in accelerators, right? Accelerating programming. We'll talk about why we actually need accelerators, why we need to accelerate applications in a couple slides. And I work with Kevin currently at the Center for Automata Processing. So back to that question, I'm sure you guys have talked about this a lot in class. why do we need accelerators? Like, why are we talking about vector processors? Why are we talking about things other than CPUs or traditional CPUs? Why do we care about GPUs? So what's wrong with CPUs today? And go ahead and answer, like why isn't a CPU sufficient? Just anything obvious to him.
I guess they have different common cases. You want to optimize for CPUs is generally operation.
Sure. So why can't we keep optimizing CPUs to do better for everything? Why isn't general purpose good enough? Okay. Sure. So there's a hardware issue, right? So a physical package problem, maybe a cost issue, right? So more transistors is higher cost. Moore's law, right? Transistors are becoming more expensive to make smaller. I think one thing that I want to talk about, just right off the bat, one of the main ones that I focus on in my research is the von Neumann bottleneck. So this is what we call von Neumann architecture. I don't know if you've ever thrown this up. Yeah, so this is kind of basic undergrad architecture, right? This is how computers are designed, modern computers, okay? So we have this arithmetic logic unit, this is the calculator, and this is the control unit, and the control unit guides the arithmetic logic unit depending on what instructions are being fetched from the memory. And then the arithmetic logic unit, depending on the control unit, does computation on data. Okay, so we have these instruction streams and these data streams. And the issue is that they all come from memory. And memory is really, really, really slow relative to computation. Normally in our heads, we think, oh, computers, the computation is slow in our brains. In computers, computation happens in picoseconds or small numbers of nanoseconds. It's the memory that's the bottleneck. Okay, memory accesses can be much, much longer than computation, and that's what we call the von Neumann bottleneck. So how do we solve the von Neumann bottleneck? Caches, memory hierarchy, right? So we put this memory hierarchy in, we have our registers, and then we put expensive but small L1 here, so we can kind of have low latency L1 accesses, L2, maybe an L3, maybe even an L4 nowadays, and then DRAM, and then some sort of non-volatile memory, like a hard disk or some sort of backing store at the very, very bottom that's, we think is kind of infinitely large to store everything. So just to get a sense for how expensive memory accesses are, what I did was I went ahead and kind of took two different CPUs and actually profiled the memory systems. So what this program does is it essentially just says pointer chasing on a certain size of data. You guys kind of did something like this.
Yes, since that's what you should have done.
Okay, so this is homework one, right? So normally I throw this up and I kind of ask people how big, based on this, there are a couple of interesting things about this graph, but based on this, how big is the L1? 32K, right? So we kind of are hitting the L1, and then all of a sudden we need to, our data set kind of spills over into the L2, so we have to start kind of paying this increase in penalty costs. And then how big is the L2? Well, okay, we can see it's probably around 256. We see we kind of start kind of thrashing, start kind of missing, and then the L3s here are kind of around, 8 megabytes and 15 megabytes respectively. This graph is also interesting, side note, because Haswell is a later architecture than Ivy Bridge, but Haswell has a longer L3 access latency. So there's some kind of trade-off going on there as far as these architectures go. But the main point of this is that, oh my god, DRAM is slow, okay? 70 to 80 nanoseconds here of access time, that versus 1 nanosecond or 2 nanoseconds down here, depending on how many gigahertz you're running at. So DRAM is really, really slow, and we need to have that memory hierarchy to help. Another thing I want to talk about just briefly, vocabulary. Here's Flynn's taxonomy. Did you go over this at the beginning of class? So Flynn's taxonomy is kind of a way of categorizing von Neumann architectures here based on the instruction stream, okay, and the data stream. We're going to, you guys kind of talked a lot about single instruction, multiple data architectures over here. But there are basically multiple different ways of doing computation here. We're going to be focusing today on single instruction, multiple data as well. Okay, so moving on. Why GPUs? Okay, so we're kind of talking about these problems with CPUs. Okay, so we addressed one, the von Neumann bottleneck, and then the second one, Moore's Law, right? Okay, but is Moore's Law really the problem? You kind of were getting at it. What is the actual problem? We can, you know, we're doing pretty good with getting more transistors on chip, but what's the real issue? If I give you twice as many transistors, can you make your computation twice as fast? Probably not. Can I maybe make those transistors run twice as fast? Could turn up the frequency? Maybe not, okay? So there's this kind of like transistor physics that we're running into here too. Okay? And this is what we call Dennard scaling. So it's really, it's not Moore's law that's really holding us back here in computing. It's actually Dennard scaling. And what Dennard scaling is, as the transistor size goes down, each essentially transistor power also goes down as well. And so as we make these transistors smaller and smaller, they also if we, you know, I make a transistor half as big, it also consumes half as much power. That means if I fit it into a constant area, I'm going to have constant power. And that's really, really good. That means if you buy a computer with twice as many transistors, it's only going to use 100 watts instead of 200 watts. The issue in modern, you know, as we kind of get down into sub-threshold, you know, lower and lower transistor nodes, like sub 90 nanometers, Dennard scaling starts to break down. So now we can make transistors smaller and smaller and smaller, and we can put more of them onto the chip, but we can't all run them at the same frequency. We can't use them all. Okay, because transistor power has all of a sudden plateaued because of leakage. We call this the breakdown in Dennard scaling. Okay, so it's these two big things, the von Neumann bottleneck, memory is slow, CPUs are fast, or computation is fast, and then the breakdown in Dennard scaling that motivates all of our accelerator research. This is why CPUs are insufficient. Okay, they're not going to scale to future generations of computing. Okay, so moving on, why GPUs? So let's design a new computer, okay, or kind of target some areas of a CPU that we can change to build an accelerator. So kind of start thinking about the Cray 1, you know, all of the papers that you guys have been reading over the semester. And let's kind of just start to list all of the things that increase IPC in a CPU. Okay, so I'll give you guys kind of the easiest one, I think, is like pipelining, right? Anything else? So just like, anybody?
Out of order
execution, sure. That's later on my list. That's not the next thing.
Branch prediction,
okay. What about like data dependencies? Register renaming, okay. Not quite the same thing as out of order execution, which is next. Okay, and then caching, we mentioned caching. All right, so we're reducing the latency. And you can see I've kind of tagged all of these with what they actually do, okay. And what we're trying to do here is reduce the stalls, reduce the penalty of that long access to DRAM, right? Okay, that's why we put all of this stuff in. If DRAM was super fast and we can have all of that data right away, we wouldn't need half of these things. Okay, and then also at the bottom here, superscalar execution, right? Having multiple functional units so we can do parallel computation at the same time if we have all of the data available and no data dependencies. And then something else that is kind of less obvious, but hyperthreading. Okay, so hyperthreading is kind of, if one thread kind of stalls in a core, you can very, very quickly swap in another thread to take advantage of the resources within that core. Okay, so all these things, again, are trying to get rid of stalls, get rid of bubbles, make sure that computation can happen when we have data on these devices. Here's an example of a CPU floor plan. I don't know if you guys have ever kind of looked at these. There's just these like beautiful kind of multicolored images I'm going to be throwing up a lot today. But this is, kind of an an older version of a CPU, so more of an academic exercise and less reflection of reality. But I want to ask if anybody can find the integer functional unit on this die. Okay, maybe it took you a while, but it's right here. It's this like little box in the middle. Okay, the L2 is pretty easy to find, right? It's like L2, oh yeah, okay, that's like half the chip. Okay, this shouldn't feel good to anyone, right? We're devoting like like 3% of the total die area to computation. And the rest of the die is devoted to coordinating computation and reducing all these stalls, okay? So this is like really, really painful. This just hurts my brain, right? I don't want to have L, you know, cache. I don't want to have all this reorder buffers. I mean, look at all the branch prediction logic over here. It's just massive. I mean, this just sucks. We want to have more computation going on the die. Here's another example of this. This is actually a Jaguar. This is a kind of an AMD mobile processor, a lighter processor, and you can kind of do the same thing. You can look at the integer functional units here, and you can see it kind of occupies, you know, a fair amount of the die, but not nearly as much as the cache and also, you know, other computational structures. And then when we actually zoom out to kind of like a larger die area and we actually look at kind of the Jaguar core clusters with this L2 cache, I mean, that integer is like, you know, so small, okay? So that hurts, okay? We want to do more computation. We want to do computation faster and more efficiently. We want to figure out how to get around the breakdown of Dennard scaling and also the von Neumann bottleneck. And we're going to rely on this intuition, okay? And this is something that you guys talked about last week, right? If you have a particular type of computation, you can tailor your architecture to accelerate that computation, but sacrifice general purpose performance. So here the intuition we're going to take advantage of is we don't really need low latency, okay? We don't really need to improve the latency of memory. That's not what we're going to focus on. If we want to improve the performance or improve throughput, all we have to do is support massive amounts of parallelism on chip. Okay, so we're going to move from a latency-oriented architecture where we have all these caches and branch predictors and out-of-order execution, making sure that things can go, you know, as soon as they're ready, to a throughput-oriented architecture. Okay, we're going to be lazier, but we're going to be much, 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 much wider. Okay, so this is what I call the trade-off, at least in GPU program, GPU architecture. So again, kind of simplistic, but this is it. It's not that much more complicated than this. Think of a CPU as like a Ferrari, right? It's really, really good at some tasks, right? Going from, you know, in a straight line very, very, very fast. So if I give you something like, you know, let's say I'm gonna give you a workload of a paper route. Which one of these, the Ferrari, or let's say like 1,000 bicycles with paper boys would be better at a paper route? Bicycles, okay. What if your paper route is only 2 houses and they're 100 miles apart? So it depends. So that is the punchline here, is we have to figure out what applications are those like complex neighborhoods that we actually would deliver papers to, right? That we're gonna throw our bicycles at. And that's data parallel applications. So so what we're gonna do with GPUs is we're basically gonna take all this stuff, okay? And we're going to rip it out, okay? So we're going to rip out all this, like, ultra-deep pipelines, okay? We're going to rip out branch prediction. We're just going to, you know, not even think about it. We're going to rip out register renaming. We're going to statically name our registers. We're also not going to execute out of order. Every thread is going to execute in order in this architecture. So we're not going to have to worry about complex, tables to keep track of, you know, reorder buffers and things like that. We're also going to either eliminate or reduce the size of our caches, which sounds really, really, really scary, but it'll be fine. And we're going to focus on these two things, okay? So we're going to take our parallel execution, right? These are our bicycles, and we're going to jack this up. And then, as we're going to talk about kind of later in this lecture, we're going to take advantage of massive amounts of hyper-threading. Okay, we're going to support many, many, many parallel threads, literally tens of thousands of threads at the same time to overcome that latency issue. Briefly, you know, I mentioned Flynn's taxonomy. There's a kind of MIMD section, multiple instruction, multiple data. So we can have like multiple cores, right? Kind of all operating in their own instruction streams. Why do we need to go SIMD? There are plenty of examples of this. Have you guys heard of like the Xeon Phi It's in like the biggest supercomputers in the world right now. The Tianhe-2, I think, is like has the kind of the peak LINPACK performance record right now, and has for like the last 3-4 years, is the Knight's Corner architecture. This architecture actually just came out. This is like over 1,000 cores on one chip in a 2D mesh. So that's pretty impressive. That's a lot of threads that we can throw out or execute. Spark T5, so it's kind of related to that UltraSpark, Wikipedia article you guys read. This is kind of that barrel processor methodology. Okay, so we can do 128 threads. So why not that? Well, SIMD lets us kind of like even crank up the parallelism even more, right? So for your vector processor, you had a single instruction fetch for how many pieces of data in the Cray-1. What was the vector width of the Cray-1? 64, okay. So you get to kind of amortize that instruction fetch over 64 data operations. And that's nice because that might allow you to kind of reduce the size of that instruction fetch hardware, right? Maybe you don't care so much about branch prediction anymore because that one instruction fetch is the cost of that one instruction fetch is going to be amortized over a lot of computation. So we can do better. That's my pitch against MIMD. So we know we have these data parallel applications, and we want to execute as many threads on chip and increase the amount of computation we're doing on chip as much as possible. So this is kind of out of the textbook, actually, I think. It's just like, yeah, we're only doing, these are all the instructions, right? We're only doing one instruction fetch here in order to coordinate this computation. So this is a heat map of a simulated CPU architecture, multi-core CPU. So you can see this is like labeled core 2. I'm sorry if you guys can't see this. Core 1. And does anybody notice anything funny? What is the weird thing? Okay, so like the core, okay, it's very, very hot. We're doing some computation. Maybe the register file isn't here. We're doing a lot of accesses. What's the other hotspot? The instruction cache, okay? So why would the instruction, that's just something that is not very intuitive, right? But a lot of power is being devoted to fetching instructions to these CPUs. Okay, we're hitting a lot in the instruction cache. So this is something that if we're able to reduce the pressure on these structures, we might be able to make them smaller, okay? Or we can make them use less power in this type of architecture. So just further motivation that instruction fetch, something that we didn't quite touch on in the last lecture, but is actually really, really important to the success of these styles of architectures. If we don't have to care about coordinating the computation, we can reduce the size of those caches and reduce power. Okay, also something we're gonna put into GPUs is lane parallelism. So previously you guys talked about Cray, right? This is Cray, okay? So we're still doing SIMD or vector computation, but we're only using one lane. Okay, so again, single instruction, multiple data, but if we add more lanes, if we add more ALUs onto the chip, we can take advantage of this actual functional parallelism here and do computation in fewer cycles. Okay. So again, all of these things are coming together, essentially create this dichotomy, right? This is our trade-off. So before we had massive caches, medium-sized ALUs, huge amount of control logic on chip. Now we're going to devote much more of our chip to compute. These are all of our bicycles. Sorry if this is like beating a dead horse, but this is really, really important. So any questions so far about this motivation? We're also giving up a lot here, so feel free to chime in with things you think are bad ideas. Okay, so now I'm going to go into kind of the one article I told you guys to read, the Enantech article. So hopefully you guys were able to get through that. This is kind of a funny example of tech journalism actually being really, really, really good and useful. It's an interesting history of that transition, which isn't captured by academia in academic papers and things like that. And I often go back to this article a lot to review GCN. So essentially what he was talking about was The AMD's Evergreen architecture, which was VLIW5, this is actually originally an ATI architecture, or developed at ATI before AMD bought them, transitioned to a VLIW4 architecture. And then all of a sudden, that was 2007, AMD completely switched their microarchitecture. They did a complete redesign and changed over to a barrel SIMD style. Okay. And the question is why? Why would they make such a huge change to their architecture? So this article talked about what happened to VLIW, why SIMD is a better option for compute than VLIW. Okay. And then also, yeah, what clever features make GCN Jack's favorite architecture. I love GCN, that's the architecture that I did research on. We actually won't cover some of my favorite features like the scalar unit, but hopefully you picked up on things like that in the article. Okay, so have you guys read any VLIW papers?
Yes.
Yeah, you have, okay. I was hoping you'd nod your head vigorously. So VLIW is great, but hopefully you guys went over the fact that classically VLIW is hard to use, okay? And that's because of the underutilization, right? You're putting a lot of pressure on the developers and also the compiler writers to take advantage of parallels in your applications. And that, it's never really worked successfully. And what papers did you read about VLIW?
The number of titles,
Okay.
And the compiler for that.
So I don't know the conclusions from those papers, but one of the reasons why VLIW hasn't been commercially successful is this problem. And we've never been able to solve this problem.
You talked about the Titanium.
Yes, yeah.
The best example, which did some things well beyond anything.
Yeah, absolutely.
It still was not commercially successful.
Right. And people at Intel are still bitter about Itanium because they love it so much and it was so well designed, but it never panned out, which may have been AMD's fault. Okay, so anyway, that's the punchline here. Okay, so we have these kind of long instruction words that we're trying to execute. This is the VLIW unit. Of kind of this is the instruction essentially for the 6900. So this is the VLIW4. This is kind of the Northern Islands architecture. And this is a quote from the article, right? One of the reasons why they picked VLIW for graphics was because graphics computations have this very particular type of format. Right, you're doing these computations over and over and over again. It's like, oh my God, that looks like a VLIW would be really, really good at that. So both NVIDIA and AMD originally had these VLIW style architectures. Okay. Now, the issue with this, which I this is just an okay figure from that article, but Ryan did a pretty good job. That if this is your instruction stream, right? So this is the end and this is the beginning. And your instructions are coming in to your pipeline. The compiler can, kind of force all of these instructions into these functional units. But when you have sequential dependencies, you end up with a ton of underutilization. So I put up this little red box here, and that's just kind of visually showing you how much is being underutilized in this example. And this is kind of contrived, but this is pretty interesting that he was able to figure this out. Right? AMD gave a presentation on their justification for going from VLIW5 to VLIW4. And they actually, in an internal study, they found that, wow, we have a ton of underutilization here. We have to do something about this.
You should probably talk about what cores means in GPUs.
Here,
just terminology.
So here, when they say Radeon cores, that's essentially a marketing term for a lane in their VLIW processor. So each one of these ALUs, each one of these letters is a Radeon core. It's just marketing. Within this, SP stands for streaming processor, I think is what they called them. So again, hopefully that number makes sense. That's a bad number. We want that number to be 5 or 4.9 or 4.8 or something like that. That would be a successful application or an application that would map well to this style of architecture. Okay. So they also put some examples of some programs here. So this is the VLIW program. I didn't quite understand this part of the article because I think they were kind of both equally easy to understand. But what we're doing here is we're essentially asking, if A is greater than B, we have two values, right, A and B. If A is greater than B, then we're going to subtract B from A and then multiply by A. If B is greater than A, then we're going to subtract A from B and multiply by B. And this is the program. Okay. In a SIMD style, which is what they migrated to, this is what the program looks like. Okay. So based on, you know, you guys' knowledge of the Cray, if you can kind of like throw back to last week, we have you can see things like execution masks, right, to handle things like branch divergence or parallel threads. Okay. And their claim is that these programs are much easier to optimize, mainly because you don't have to worry about things like this. Okay, so you can think about the program in a different way inside your compiler and apply more classic compiler optimizations to these. I think it's a little bit of a weak argument here, but I also am not, you know, a GPU compiler developer, so I don't quite know the insides of that, but I might be able to dig out some information on that. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, quick break. Does anyone know the answer to this?
Less than
10? Less than 10 is right. Good job. Does anybody else have, Ted, what I'm going to pick on you? Make a guess.
Less than 9.
Less than 9. Okay. It's actually 5. Okay. 3 actually came back like a day and a half ago. So they're actually, are there any Chinese nationals here? So China just launched their second space laboratory and 2 astronauts just launched, gosh, like within a month to that laboratory. So we have quite a few people in space right now. 3 more, this is them actually, that's a picture from yesterday in Kazakhstan. And this is the next group of astronauts going up. This is Thomas Pesquet, this is Oleg, I don't know his last name, and that's Peggy Whitson. Peggy Whitson may break the record for US time in space, regardless of gender. She's gonna smash the women record, but she's one of our most decorated astronauts. Okay, back to GPU land. Okay, so VLIW sucks. That's what we've identified. It doesn't suck for graphics, it just sucks for compute. Okay, so we're really focusing again on parallel threads, data parallel computation. We're using these graphics cards to do computation other than graphics. We want it to be a little more general purpose here. Okay, but what replaces VLIW? We're gonna go with this parallel vector processing style, okay? More the Cray 1 style, and also the parallel SIMD units that I introduced earlier on in this lecture. So this is actually a view, obviously very, very high level block diagram of the GCN compute unit, a GCN SIMD unit. So the width that they picked here was 16. So you can do in a single cycle 16, 30, you know, single precision floating point operations per cycle. Okay. Anybody notice anything about this slide? That's weird. This is one. Massive. Okay, how many what's the size of the register file in an Intel, you know, server class architecture per core? I mean, let's be generous here. We're going to include the, you know, architected register file and the physical register file if those exist. Okay, what, 1,000? Maybe like 1K? Maybe. Okay, let's double that and be generous. 2K. We're gonna have 64K of register file. That's insane. Okay, so you can see how we're setting this architecture up to be able to support a lot of threads. If we have a lot of parallel threads and we only have 1,000 register file, then the register file per thread is going to be tiny. Okay, some threads might not even have registers to use. So that's how we're gonna treat this from the ground up, is something that again, is going to have a lot of a parallel computation going on. And this might seem a little bit counter to my argument earlier about the memory hierarchy, right? We're struggling with the memory hierarchy. It's this pyramid, okay? But for parallel computation, we want to kind of make it fatter at the top, okay? But in order to do that, we might have to cut out some of the lower pieces. And that this is the first step.
Something that people who remember is we read about the Terra supercomputer, which also
I actually don't know the Terra.
Huge register file for basically the same type of reason. This should remind you a lot of that.
Okay, so this is a kind of a high-level block diagram of the GCN compute unit. This is like an AMD slide, okay? So this is going to be, you know, more accurate than you know, Ryan's little PowerPoint drawings here. Okay, this is the SIMD unit, okay? So you can see kind of our vector units or our SIMD. Now you can kind of understand this, right? 4 by SIMD 16, this means it's 16 wide, okay? So there are like 16 little ALUs here, or Radeon cores, or CUDA cores, whatever you want to call them. Okay, and there are gonna be 4 of them. Okay, each one of these SIMD units has 64K of register file. So that means there's 256K of register file per compute unit and tens of compute units per GPU. So we're in the megabytes of register file here. Yikes. We'll talk a little bit about this scheduler later. The local data share, which I'll go over kind of later, I'll switch over kind of more NVIDIA specific terminology on Wednesday. But the local data share, because we're kind of sacrificing a lot of our L1 cache. Look, they put the L1 cache over here. Isn't that nice? You know, it's this like tiny little sliver over, okay? You know, it's only 16 kilobytes. That's insane, okay? So, you know, we went from like 1K register file, 32 kilobyte L1, now to 256K register file and 16K L1. It's kind of silly, okay? But what we get in return, okay, is we're gonna get this kind of smart cache. Excuse me, it's extremely dumb cache. But you're going to be able to manipulate it. So what they allow you to do is within your computation, if you know that you have data you're going to use a lot, okay, you expose your own locality, temporal or spatial locality, you can store it in this little scratch pad and manipulate it. Okay. So you actually kind of have to be aware when you program GPUs of the memory hierarchy. Oh, I know I'm going to access this a lot, so I'm going to allocate it in local data share here. And I'll show you guys how to do that. Another thing is the scalar unit. So the Cray had a scalar unit?
Yes.
Yeah. So sometimes you are actually statically able to identify operations that are common amongst all of these different threads, okay? Or at least the threads within kind of one execution, you know, one kind of wave or wavefront here. And you don't want to execute those in these SIMD ALUs, because you're kind of building in a lot of wasted space. You're either doing a lot of redundant computation here, or if you turn off and mask all of the threads off, you're doing a lot of nothing. So what AMD did is they actually built their own little scalar ALU core that accepts its own instruction stream. Okay, so the compiler is going to kind of run through your program and identify parts of it that would run better on the scalar unit and are common amongst all of your threads. Okay, so that's another kind of weird thing, right? We're kind of straddling this boundary of like, okay, you know, what's better to run in parallel, what's better to run in serial. This is actually, you know, the GCN compute unit is kind of a true heterogeneous architecture of itself. I think that's all I want to say about that picture. This is a Tahiti dye photo. I'm a big dye photo fan. I think these are really pretty. But you can kind of see, you know, I wish I could kind of back up very quickly to the CPU one, but you can see this is much more regular, right? Structures are a lot smaller. You don't see massive, massive, massive cache structures, okay? We can kind of pick out maybe some structures here, some rectangular structures that might be compute units. Okay, so somebody kind of did this for us here. So here, you can't really see these black boxes here, but about the size of my thumb is the data cache. About the size of my thumb is the instruction cache. Tiny, tiny, tiny caches, although they are distributed over the whole chip. This is the SIMD unit, 2 and 3. This is 0 and 1, okay? So we have four SIMD units here. This is the scalar ALU, again, that kind of like small little core that's doing scalar instructions. And then this is the L1 as well as like some very, very large buffers to support computation. Okay. Now Tahiti was released, what did I say? 2012? Okay, so this is what AMD GPUs look like in 2015. Pretty much the same thing, right? The GCN compute unit architecture hasn't changed much. They really nailed it on the first try, at least the microarchitecture, okay? If you look closely at these little boxes, it's the same thing. You have four 16-wide SIMD units, local data share of about the same size, the scalar unit, the L1, and the scheduler. There's nothing different that they have published that they want to make marketable, which means they haven't done any major design changes to this. Okay. I think that's pretty interesting because you'd think that there would be kind of these massive changes. No, GPUs kind of are we're treating them like CPUs now, right? We're mature enough in this, design process that we've really kind of settled on this great middle ground. And they did it right on the first try after the VLIW mess up. You do actually have these kind of decently sized L2 caches out here. I forgot what the L2 on Fiji is. Maybe somebody can Google that for me. No L3. Okay. No L4. Okay. Some kind of server class. Xeons have L4 now. EDRAM. Okay, so we're going to kind of rip out the L3 to make room for all of this computation. Another thing that's worth noting that has less to do with what I'm beating you guys over the head with is this thing here. This is actually the Fiji die in the center. And does anybody know what those are? You guys talked about memory at all? A little bit. So. Yeah, this is what's called the interposer. So this is kind of the board that the silicon sticks onto. You can actually flip it over and solder it on. Those are actually memory chips. That's actually the DRAM, the GDDR. What they did was they actually took multiple wafers and they stacked them on top of each other and then put them right on the interposer right next to the GPU die. Okay, so we're taking memory now and we're moving it closer in order to get over the von Neumann bottleneck too. And this reduces latency, reduces power, so this also has to do with Dennard scaling too. Ends up being really expensive. You can shrink the size of your PCB now, so maybe end up in more interesting form factors. Anyway, I think this is really cool, especially that it ended up in an actual product. So just to go over some other kind of modern GPU architectures, this is NVIDIA's Kepler architecture. Okay, have any of you guys done GPU programming before? Most likely it was CUDA, and you were on something like a Kepler or a Fermi. Okay. The architecture, despite being a different color and looking a little differently, looks remarkably similar here. Each one of these little green boxes is meant to represent a different ALU lane in their SIMD unit. So each one of these columns is a SIMD unit. A SIMD ALU. So if you count those up, that they're 16 wide. So 16 is kind of this interesting design spot here. Okay. Each one of these are kind of the computational ALUs here. And then we have a load store unit and then a special functional unit for kind of like graphics transcendental operations and things like that. Okay. One interesting thing, so here we have probably like 12 by 16 wide. Before we saw 4 by 16 wide. Per kind of control unit, per register file. Okay. NVIDIA just like went for it. Okay. They put a ton of parallel computation on these machines. And the peak throughput was really, really impressive. And these actually, even Fermi, the architecture before Kepler, is still really impressive at some integer workloads. Okay. So I don't actually know that, but this is kind of the Kepler die. So you can see kind of like a little more regular, a little different than kind of a modern CPU die. Kind of these massive SMX clusters now. Okay. Maybe some kind of, you know, this is like L2 and kind of memory interconnect in here. But, oh gee. But anyway, I think these are pretty. So that Kepler was 2012. This was kind of NVIDIA's answer to Fiji, to kind of GCN. Okay, so Kepler looked like this. Right, we have this control logic and like 192 different ALU lanes that we could put threads into. And they moved in Maxwell to this style. Okay. So what they did was they actually decreased the amount of parallel computation and increased the amount of control logic. Okay, so kind of the opposite of what have been motivating this whole time, right? There is now more black on here and less green. But what that gave them was more performance per core, okay, and 2x performance per watt. Now why is that, why does that even make sense? Like, why is that a better idea than this?
So if you're doing anything like general purpose computing, then you're going to have branches and stuff. The more that you have to spread the losses of that kind of computing across more cores, the more performance you lose.
Yeah. I don't have an answer for that, but I think that's exactly right. I think they just overdid it with this architecture. Too much SIMD width, right? You can make your SIMD unit, you know, 1,000, you know, 1K instructions wide or data units wide, but you have to have underlying applications that are going to run in that architecture in order to take advantage of that intuition. Of course, you could write some kind of contrived benchmark to actually, you know, take advantage of that and have a massive, you know, peak flops, you know, supercomputer, but nobody would be able to use it. So I think that's exactly right. Okay. One interesting thing, which I realize now I actually didn't include in these slides, so I can throw up some on Wednesday, is the same thing is actually happening now with neural net computation. So did you guys, is anybody in here like machine learning? Nobody? You guys are all architects? Nice, okay. Well, like, machine learning is a thing. I don't know if you guys have heard. And NVIDIA has actually changed their architecture to respond to machine learning. Machine learning actually, you know, scientific computations require kind of larger precision, right? We want double precision. Scientists demanded double precision. And so NVIDIA and AMD kind of bent over backwards in order to support that, to get these cards into supercomputers. Now machine learning people are like, no. We don't even want 32-bit precision. We want 16-bit precision. We want 8-bit precision. We just want more throughput. We want more ALUs and we want smaller data widths. So NVIDIA now is actually supporting kind of half precision operations in order to double their throughput, which is really interesting. So anyway, just kind of like, you know, marketing slides here.
So is the better performance per watt also related to less distance for signals to travel, or no?
Maybe, yeah. I don't know, yeah. What they did too is I threw these up. These are kind of bigger, right? So you can see that this is like a massive shared register file, right?
Yeah.
Like how many ports are in the, you know, this is like insane. So maybe, you know, that is probably exactly right. Breaking up a lot of these control structures might make them more efficient and simpler to implement when you actually lay them out in the circuit. Anyway, it's kind of interesting too that this is, you know, this is looking more like GCN too, right? We have this kind of more like, you know, four wide SIMD architecture here. Okay, so any questions about any of these slides? Yeah.
I'm curious, what is lost in this move to rather than grass for parallelism from DLIW? So it's clearly better for general compute stuff, but have we lost performance per watt in graphics programming, like strictly graphics?
That's a really good question. So like if, you know, if the architectures diverge and we have one just for graphics and one just for a general purpose compute, I think probably one argument that, you know, I think GPUs required general purpose computation even for graphics. So things like shader programs just became more complex. People wanted to do more interesting things with their shader programs. So that might have been one of the reasons why that also would have motivated this switch for graphics. Yeah, otherwise I don't have a good answer for that. Okay, so parallelism. We have all these SIMD ALUs, we have all these threads, massive amount of threads running on this device, okay? But we've only been talking about SIMD, okay? SIMD helps increase utilization, right? We're trying to solve this VLIW problem, okay? But we never actually solved the memory access latency problem. Okay, right? DRAM is still really, 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 really expensive to access. So no matter what, each one of our parallel threads is still going to be very, very, very slow. Okay. So how do we solve this problem, right? We figured out, you know, SIMD parallel processing is going to be more efficient, right? We can rip out all this massive hot hardware. We can, you know, get rid of our L3 cache, increase the compute. But how do we tackle this? And that kind of has to do with the other, you know, hint. It's like the other Wikipedia article that I sent you. Did you guys actually get a chance to read that? Did anybody kind of read deeper? Have you guys heard about Spark before? Or you guys didn't do Spark in class, did you?
Yeah, we mentioned it when we talked about SMT generally.
Yeah, okay.
Pointed to the actual standard SMT norm using Spark,
right,
which is not what you're referring to.
So, Spark, what they did, well, let me ask this question first, okay. So if we load these, you know, if we have different SIMT instructions come in, okay, so we have our scheduler here, and our scheduler is going to schedule one instruction here, it's parallel, it's going to try to load data, okay, into the register file. If we schedule the same instruction or similar instruction to all those SIMD units, where we're just going to have to kind of stall and wait. We didn't solve our problem. We're just going to have to sit there for, you know, 100 nanoseconds and wait for our memory to come, our data to come back. And, you know, the question is, how do CPUs solve that problem? Well, Spark did it in a really interesting way, right? Just like our trade-off that we talked about earlier, they said, look, we're not going to think about single-threaded latency. We don't care about single-threaded latency. We just are going to support as many threads on this chip as possible. And we're going to use the intuition that stalls can be hidden by simultaneous multiprocessing, which you guys talk about, or simultaneous multithreading.
We saw this in the Terra supercomputer.
Yeah.
This is exactly the approach they took.
Great.
Do you think it's register with those buttons?
No.
Yes.
Register with those buttons.
Like for out of order processing? Or?
Yes, and
not
less.
Oh, okay. So the idea here is, if you have a massive stall, so let's go back to this, okay? If you have a massive stall here, right, you issue an instruction and it needs a load, okay? And it has to wait 100 nanoseconds to get that load. Sleep this thread, okay? Kick that instruction, you know, over into the load store queue and free up this SIMD unit for another thread or wavefront or another 64 threads to come in here and do computation. Maybe it's another load, that's fine. But at least we're issuing more instructions here, okay? We're getting more computation in the pipeline, we're starting more computation. And of course, we're gonna be able to do whatever we want here, right? If there's an ALU computation ready to go, we wanna do that right away, no matter what we're waiting for among other threads. And this is, you know, this is the genius of the UltraSpark, okay? For these kind of like massive server processors, you know, maybe this is one of the reasons why they also weren't a commercial success, but, you know, their idea was you can wait, you know, you can wait a millisecond for your response. And we're gonna, you know, take advantage of that and support hundreds of different threads on this architecture. you know, people call this like a barrel processor. So I like the like distinction, like the category here, but I really kind of hate that name. It's like really non-descriptive. But basically the idea of a barrel processor is you have threads in a pool, okay, or you have different instruction streams in this barrel. And the algorithm for doing computation in this processor is you reach into the barrel and you get an instruction that doesn't have any dependencies. So let's say a load, okay? We want to load from these addresses. And then I execute it. And then I rotate the barrel or I shake it up. Then I go back and I grab an instruction. I don't care which instruction I get, as long as it doesn't have any sequential or data dependencies, okay? So, you know, if I grab the next instruction from that original load, I'm gonna throw it back into the barrel, right? I wanna just get more instructions. I wanna pull instructions out of this barrel and fill all of my SIMD units with computation. So, what was I gonna say? So what are the benefits here? So the weaknesses are kind of obvious, right? What are the weaknesses? I say they're obvious, but. It's slower, right? We're kind of just existing in a world where, you know, the latency is long and we're not even gonna try to solve that with cache hierarchy. Or maybe we're gonna try, but the cache is gonna be used in a different way. It's not nearly gonna be large enough. You know, we couldn't put enough L1, you know, per thread on these cores to get anywhere close to some sort of, you know, a Xeon processor. Okay. What can we do to cache? I kind of mentioned this earlier. Do we need an L3? Right. So what other things are, you know, reduce latency in a processor that you guys have learned about, that you can rip out? All of those other structures that I talked about, right? All of the out of order processing, right? Things that can reduce the penalty of those stalls. We can just get rid of them. We don't have to have them in this architecture. A lot of those structures are really power hungry. And so out of order execution kind of classically is really, really, you know, really power hungry. And also expensive in area. Things like branch prediction, right? Do we care? Do we care about a branch mispredict anymore? No, because if we mispredict, it doesn't matter what the penalty is. It just has to be less than the DRAM access that we designed for. We can just sleep that thread and get another thread in. So, the underlying issue here is that single-threaded performance is going to be terrible. But again, we're making an assumption about our underlying computation here. We don't care about single-threaded performance. We care about aggregate throughput. We're a server. We're an HPC center. Okay. We want throughput. We want megabytes per second, gigabytes per second. We don't care about nanoseconds. So this is kind of the punchline here. This is what the compute unit looks like when you consider all of the barrel processing aspects of this architecture. Okay. So GCN is SIMD. It's vector. It's heterogeneous, it's also scalar. Can you guys read this, by the way?
Mostly.
No, not really. This is the scalar unit. Okay, so it's SIMD, it's vector, whatever that means, right? You know, it's kind of confluence, okay? But it's, you know, it has these kind of pipeline ALUs, it executes a lot of data per individual instruction. And it's also a barrel processor. So each one of these is an instruction buffer that can support up to 10 different threads of execution. Excuse me, 10 different waves of execution. Each wave in this processor is a, you know, kind of chain gang group of 64 threads. So that means if we have four SIMD units that can support 10 waves of instructions, and each one of those waves has 64 threads, that's 2,560 threads per compute unit that you can support. That's insane. That's again why we need all of this register file for each one of those threads, ideally. Okay. I mean, this is the barrel, right? We have all of these instruction streams going on, and this arbiter is able to kind of pick from each one of those barrels and assign them one per cycle. to each one of these SIMD units and kind of go around in a round robin fashion. I still think it was definitely round robin when in 2012, and I think it still is round robin. I don't think you need to be that sophisticated about how you dole out these instructions. Okay. So yeah, GCN is kind of just a, you know, it's a massively weird thing. When we say kind of it's a GPU architecture, it's not quite SIMD or vector, right? It's not kind of, you know, calling back to Cray. It's also, you know, not a barrel processor. It's not Spark. It's this kind of weird hybrid. And it's been really, really effective and really powerful. And the NVIDIA architectures don't look much different from this. So that is actually all of the material that I had for you guys today. Does anybody have any questions?
I guess for this kind of technology, other than applications where you're going to use this for maybe general purpose computation, just at a massive scale, parallel scale, who gets a lot of the benefit out of this? Because would this like be overkill for someone buying a graphics card for a PC?
It depends on what your use case is. So this is, and that also, yeah, there are a few different questions that you ask there. So these architectures still struggle with like the best graphics that, you know, get best games and, you know, largest screens that you can throw at them. We can always build screens with more pixels. We might be reaching a plateau where like kind of we just literally can't discern, between the pixels, right? So going from like 4K right up against your face as you're gaming to 5K might not actually be that different or add that much to your user experience, but it might make the computation much, much harder. GPUs also kind of live, did that answer your first question?
Yeah.
So this computational power is actually necessary because there are so many pixels on these screens, and we have to do, it's kind of like matrix transformations. I don't know if you've ever taken a graphics course, but if you're like in a first person shooter, right, and you have to move your person, you're actually doing a huge transformation on the world around you in order to kind of make it seem like you're moving. The second answer, or thing I didn't mention before, is that graphics cards have to lead this double life now. They have to be both good at graphics and also ideally both good at supercomputing or whatever other markets exist out there for GPUs, whatever NVIDIA thinks they can sell them for. Machine learning is becoming a huge part of that kind of alternate life of GPUs. They're designing, not entirely new dies necessarily, but they're injecting features into these architectures to satisfy those needs, because they're kind of projecting that those are going to be huge, make them a lot of money at the end of the day.
So is that like a business decision then to combine like consumer graphics application GPUs with hopefully whatever, clients are going to want for supercomputing and just build one product?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is, yes, exactly. And it's one of the great accidents of the 2000s that these GPUs were so easily modifiable to become great vector processors, essentially. If you wanted to, if you were sitting around in 2002 and you're like, I think we need a new vector computer, I'm gonna do it better than the rest of them, like you'd be fighting 40 years of history and some really big names. All they had to do here was kind of come up with a different programming model, maybe, or invent a programmable shader, and then very slowly over the years introduce new features to make it easier and easier and easier, all the while buoyed by this like massive amount of revenue that they're making off of graphics sales. So that has definitely held these architectures back in some ways, right? Like there's some, coming from the other side of things, right? There are some things I would love to rip out of this architecture that have a lot to do with graphics, but have nothing to do with compute, or the style, the type of compute that I want to do.
But the rationale would be that if there are two separate products made by a company, it wouldn't be viable anymore, and then it wouldn't exist in the first place.
Yeah, it might be viable, I just don't know if they probably wouldn't make as much money. Yeah. So yeah, it's kind of an inefficiency of capitalism, maybe.
What's the state of compilers for these things? It's still pretty much just write your shader, whatever the computer is, throw it onto the GPU and get the results back? Or?
Yeah, pretty much. Is your question more about compilers or like the ease of programming?
So one of the big limitations, in my experience, is that even if you give this thing more compute capabilities, you still have to write a separate program and pick up the interface.
Yeah, definitely.
There's buying standards, like program OpenCL differently than CUDA.
Right.
So I don't know, I'm just curious.
Yeah, programmability is an issue. This is not a cure-all. Did you guys notice when you're reading the article that he, that was published in 2011, right? And he was really excited about APUs. You know, APUs are right around the corner. We have these CPUs and GPUs on the same chip, and AMD, you know, has all this exciting stuff coming out about how we're going to be able to utilize this heterogeneous architecture to really kick Intel's butt. And that never materialized. And that's because of some of the programmability issues. Or maybe less programmability, but do those applications exist? Do we really need a CPU plus a GPU? Are all applications, you know, have these kind of massive parallel loads sitting right in the middle of the sequential instruction stream that we have to accelerate? Maybe a handful, but not most of them. Another thing about the compilers, one issue, people complain a lot about AMD's driver and the state of their driver, and that actually has a lot to do with this big, massive leap from VLIW to SIMD. A lot of legacy code, and AMD is like, okay, TI, you're part of our company now, and they hire everybody. And then they tell them, okay, now you're going to completely redesign your graphics architecture. And oh, by the way, you have to build a completely new compiler for this. And also, we have to now have a driver stack that supports all of this legacy hardware. And it has to be extremely fast for these new products, because that's what's going to make us all this money. Not the greatest business decision, right? I mean, that's like massive amounts of engineering overhead that they didn't think that they'd have to pour into these products. And that's one of the reasons why the software kind of was lagged behind. AMD just, within the last year, discontinued support for the VLIW architectures and open sourced their compiler. They essentially forked it so that they had a public version and then kind of a proprietary version. It's all based on LLVM, so a lot of compiler transformations that might not have been applicable to VLIW architectures. You know, it's the state of the art compiler transformations, things that are in LLVM. People contribute to this all the time. This is like a really, you know, hot production compiler, really high performance. They can take advantage of for free. So I think everybody kind of like breathed this big sigh of relief over there when they discontinued the support and open sourced their compiler, because it became a lot less work for them. Okay, so on Wednesday, I'm going to maybe tie up some loose ends, some ideas that I had while I was presenting this. And then transition to CUDA and talk about CUDA. How do you program these things? Okay. Are we going to do explicit vector operations? And do a little bit of like maybe some CUDA history, but then get into some examples of some CUDA programs. And then I'll spend kind of the last probably 20-30 minutes showing you guys the actual assignment that you'll be doing. Okay, so we'll kind of, you know, I really want this to be low overhead. You know, I'm not going to throw you in the deep end here as far as logistics goes. Okay, I want to really hold your hand, logging into the cluster, submitting jobs, using GPUs, debugging GPUs, things like that. I want you guys to spend as much time programming these things as possible. So we'll kind of start CUDA on Wednesday. Feel free to send me any. Do they have my email?
Probably not.
You can probably Google for me or ask Charles, but if you guys have any questions between now and Wednesday, feel free to ask them. Or you can ask on Wednesday before class too.
So that's everything. So general course notes, I'm grading homework two, so that should, I hope to have it graded by next week, and also to spend some time next week talking about how you answer questions like what's the maximum rate of instructions you can execute, which we have a lot of interpretations of, things like that. And just generally going over the homework. And so the rest of the course, so we're gonna do, after Wednesday, we're gonna do look at a few GPU papers, maybe 1 or 2 days worth. And then my plan is to spend some time on accelerators more generally. So FPGAs and some custom ASIC stuff.
The cool stuff.
What?
The cool stuff. GPUs are boring research now because they're too practical. They work too well.
They're solved. And I have a few other remaining topics for the rest of the semester. If you have things you'd like me to cover, let me know. My plan so far is to cover security a bit. And warehouse scale computers in addition to that, and maybe memory technologies, and then 1 or 1.5 days of exam review, and then we have a final, which I will try to give you an outline before we have it. But it will basically be questions about the papers, which should be general enough that you shouldn't need to memorize any terms from the papers, but you should know like what the thing in the paper was good for. And you should also probably remember what you did in the homeworks.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks, everyone.
Yes.
Yeah.
So covering architectural science
is something that we need to kind of.
Most of the work in quantum computing is on the theory side. If people haven't built quantum computers as well. Build classical quantum computers larger than my quantum computer. There's other types of quantum computers which have been built which are quantum computers.